in the rain.
We say what we say, we do what we feel, we gotta keep it real.
In the rain.
All about the crap of screenwriting. Fill my bottle up with lightning up in the rain room. Before the stars can be paid, there gotta be a dope ass story on the page. Let the beast about the cage, that light about the dark. Can you build the inferno from an itty bitty spark? Coffee shop hustlers rise with the cream. A million other writers, same Hollywood dream. Your pen and paper, all like bullets in the gun. Write what you feel, say what you want in the red room. We say what we say, we do what we feel, we gotta keep it real.
In the red room,
all about the crap of screenwriting. Fill my bottle up with lightning up in the red room.
So look, if you guys are grown, let's go ahead and get in. Yeah, what's up, y'all? It's your boy, Hilliard Guest. You guys are listening to the Screenwriters Rant Room, where we keep it real, we keep it opinionated, we keep it what, Tracy?
2016.
We say that because we're better than 100. What's up, y'all? You guys know how we do it on the Rant Room. On this show, we discuss entertainment, TV, film, music, culture, but our focus is always screenwriting, stories, craft, and shit like that. So y'all hear him, my man over here, Tracy Grant.
What it do, what it do?
Sitting in for Lisa Bolakaja.
What's up, Bolakaja? Get back soon.
Keep doing your
fantasy, fiction, horror, adventure, sci-fi writing panelist expert.
Damn near every week she got a damn panel she's on or something. So you guys know how we do it on the Rant Room. If you guys are grown, let's go ahead and get it in. So today, we got my girl, my new friend over here, Miss Krista Vernoff, writer, producer, the pimp star herself, former actress. I'm sure I'm forgetting 9 other hyphens. Mother. And it's Father's Day today.
Badass.
I like that one. That's a good one.
Now we're talking.
Okay.
It's Father's Day. My daughter has a good father though, so I can't take the credit on Father's Day.
All right. So we're sitting here with Krista Vernoff, you guys. And I always say this little saying. If you don't know who she is, Google her, bitch. Google her.
It's like before a first date.
Exactly. Like, look me up. You don't know who I am? Shoot. Anyway, she's been on some of the top shows out there, including one of my favorites, where we're going to get really into, Shameless. I talk about Shameless all the time.
You do.
All the time. Well, I think that's partly why the girl on Facebook referred us that I should have, because I always talk about Shameless. Like, Shameless is the show. I'm telling you, you want to learn how to write some gritty shit?
Love that.
You should be watching Shameless.
Okay?
You know, I talk about Shameless all the time, too.
Yeah, I'm sure.
By the time we're done with this podcast, I'm going to have 27 emails from the writers of Shameless talking about Shameless.
Okay.
For me, it's interesting because when Lisa's here, also L Boogie White, the other co-host, Linnell
White,
like, they're big horror fans, fantasy, sci-fi, action, adventure fans. I am not so much. I'm big Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Derrick was here. Yeah. We do that, but they have a lot of conversations of which I'm not a part as a fan. But Shameless is my shit. For lack of a better term, it's just. So, very excited that you're here.
It's relatable.
It's relatable.
Yes, and it's all about. For instance, here's I was explaining this to somebody recently about Shameless, because I was talking to a female writer and she was like, "Well, what show should I write?" And I was like, "Well, if it stays on, and you decide this is what you want to write, if you don't want to write any other show, you should write a Shameless." And here's why, just my opinion, right? I said, "Here's why." I said, "Fiona's character and the way that they've built this family, it's." To me, and you know more about it than I do, because damn it, you on the damn show. Didn't want to bring me in last year. Anyway, no, I'm kidding. So, to me, that show will set you free. And what I mean is, it opens up the door for any smart producer, EP, whatever, who's staffing, to see if you can handle this show, you can probably handle almost any show, in my opinion. Here's why. Character, development, family, love, passion, anger, grittiness. I mean, there's not. Oh, I was about to say. Yeah. And it's funny, too. Yeah. It has all those elements in one.
Yeah.
probably about the only show that I could think of right now that has all the elements in one. In every episode, at some point, you almost get teary-eyed at some point.
That's awesome.
Ain't that a drop?
Very.
That's real talk.
Very over the top.
That's real talk. You know, that's one of the main reasons that I actually went, that I actually took that job.
Okay.
Is that I was, you know, I was tired and I had a little kid and I had left Grey's Anatomy so I could be home with my kid more. I was developing.
Mm-hmm.
And my agent called and said, you know, Shameless is hiring. And I was like, I don't want to staff. I'm tired. I want to be with my kid. And he said, well, first watch it because he knows me really well. And I hadn't seen the show. He's like, let's watch it over the weekend and then we'll talk about it. But the other thing was, you know, you need this credit on your resume if you want to get into edgier fare because as a woman who'd been writing Grey's Anatomy
real
for
talk.
7 years, yes. real talk, it's, you know, you sort of hope that by that point in your career, somebody could look at your resume and go, well, she did Grey's Anatomy, she also did Law and Order, and she also did Charmed, and she's probably a versatile person. Mm-hmm. But I don't think particularly as a woman, this town is inclined to assume anything.
Talk about
need
it.
Need to earn everything. Yes. And it was like, oh, I need an edgier, less... No joke, this was the word, less female credit on my resume if I want everybody to understand that I can develop anything and that I can sort of navigate any voice that that I choose to. And so it was that, and also that I had heard extraordinary things about John Wells from good friends who had said, if you ever have a chance to go work for him, go do it, because you'll learn a lot. And so I went, and that I both of those things have turned out to be true. Shameless has... helped in terms of, I think, industry perception of what I can do. Mm-hmm. And also, I've learned a lot from John.
Wow. So she's had what I call a twofer, Shonda and John Wells. So you got to learn from both camps, right? Am I right?
You are right. You are right. I would also
Dick
say
Wolf. Well, yeah, also, if we really take it back,
sure.
Yeah. Yes. And I was there in the very early years of Shonda, so I would say that I also got to teach in both camps. Shonda was new to TV, and I wasn't.
Okay. Okay.
So yes, but I learned a lot working with Shonda.
All right.
And yeah, Dick Wolf. I did one episode of Law and Order.
Okay.
Brad Kern was a tremendous teacher to me too, and he was the showrunner on Charmed.
Okay. So let's go back a little bit. Let's tell the kids where you're from and how you got into the game. Because you used to be an actor too. So how did that how did that all come about?
I was an actor. I went to theater school. I went to the College of Fine Arts at Boston University. I was a classical theater girl.
Really?
And and in my
hence how she sits. You got that.
Very
sitting up straight.
I got theatrical.
Look at her.
You know,
had a little bit of dance class. I see you. I see you.
I went to acting school. I was an actor. I was raised by actors. And and my senior year in school, I took a playwriting class from an extraordinary teacher and mentor who has since passed, named John Lipsky, an incredible playwright. And I wrote a play, and it was like a revelation in my life. It was like, oh, you can feel this deeply satisfied and not crazy and insecure and thinking you're too fat all the time the way you do as an actor.
Right.
Like, what is this? And I decided that that was it. I'd written one play. And I was going to quit acting and be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody who loved me told me that that was a fear-based decision, that I here I was graduating. BU was like number two to Juilliard at the time. Mm-hmm. It was a really great theater training program. It was a cuts-based program. Here I was. I was graduating. There were only 17 of us who'd made it through from like an initial 64.
Wow.
So, and I took one writing class and was like, I'm throwing it all away. And so everybody was like, you can't. And at that age and at that time, you know, it was sort of everybody. Mm. Nobody was like, yeah, go be a writer.
Of course.
And so I moved
to New
York.
This is last year, by the way. She didn't tell you that.
Of course.
I'm so young. I moved to New York and I got a job waiting tables and I supposedly was there to be an actor.
Okay.
But I took a screenwriting class at the New School because I couldn't let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a movie writing class. But in that class, that teacher told me that she thought I was a TV writer because I very clearly think in dialogue. I think in dialogue rather than thinking in visuals, probably because I was steeped like a tea bag in theater,
right,
which is dialogue. It's similar to TV. And so I wrote that script, and then I lived in New York for a couple more years and, you know, drank too much and quit drinking. And finally, it was just like, I'm not doing anything here as an actor. And so I decided that I would move to Portland because I had a friend, Peter Page, now running the Foster, created
I know
the
Peter
Fosters.
Very well.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
He's my best friend forever.
All right. And I'm trying to get him on the show for like a year and a half.
Okay,
but
so
I'm just busy.
Oh,
you know, like he got a job or something.
I'll talk to him. Talk
like
to
he's a showrunner or something. You know what I mean?
So, Pete, actually, the two people who I followed to Portland, Oregon, no joke, because we went to school together and we were friends and they were making lives in Portland, were Peter Page and Michaela Watkins.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's interesting.
Yes. Huh. So we all were in Portland together being theater actors.
Okay.
And I did that for a couple of years. And then in the second year that I was in Portland, I made my living acting. I got my equity card and I didn't have to wait tables that year. I did wait tables a little bit. I was a singing waitress on the Portland Spirit.
Uh-oh.
But I didn't have to. I made my living acting. And once I had done that, I felt like I had proven something to my friends and family who thought that my writing calling was sort of fear-based thinking. And I mean it. I was like, I did it. I proved it. I am done. I put my headshots in storage. I packed what I could into a car, and I moved to Los Angeles. Peter moved down a few months before me. He sort of paved the way. And then I came down, and then Michaela came down a few months behind me.
Wow.
And then our other friend, Bill Harper, who was a friend we made in the theater community there, moved down behind Michaela. Now he runs Grey's Anatomy.
Wow.
So we all came down here like on a wing and a prayer and then helped each other.
Wow.
To the degree that we could. And so I moved down behind Peter, and I had written a whole bunch of this. I skipped that. I was writing the whole time I was in Portland. I was rehearsing and I was writing and I was doing plays and I'd be sort of frantically writing and people would be like, what? This is kind of a weird day job. I was like, I was treating my acting career like a day job.
Right.
My heart was with the writing and I came to understand that as fear-based as it may look to other people, it was actually inspiration-based for me. And I had to follow it. I had to follow it. I had no call anymore to act. And so I moved to LA. I never even told anyone I was an actor. It was over. And Peter gave some spec scripts that I'd written to his friend Chris Lasada, who was an assistant at some lit agency where his friend, who was also an assistant, got promoted to agent at some smaller lit agency. And so it was like through my friends who were assistants that I ended up with my first agent.
Interesting.
And that was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
But not terribly different than some of what you hear today as far as people getting started, and the whole agent relationship, the importance.
Somebody referred me
on the television side,
but it sounds like you were ready though.
I had the product. I was writing and writing and writing. Peter and I wrote a movie together.
Portland.
It was called Waiting. It was about waiting tables.
Is that the one he directed?
No.
Oh, I knew there was one he directed that he wrote.
He did.
Yeah.
That was
because our friend Mark Samuel was in it.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Say Uncle was great.
Okay.
No, we never made that movie, but the first pilot I ever sold and made for ABC was called Introducing Lenny Rose.
Okay.
And it was the same. The movie that Peter and I wrote was an adaptation of the pilot that I had written in that screenwriting class at the New School. And then I ended up sort of pitching the same world, actors and artists in New York. And I got to make that pilot. It didn't go to series, but I got, you know, somebody gave me $7 million to go to New York and shoot it.
Okay.
And that was amazing.
Whoa. Where my 10% at, girl? You see what I'm talking about?
They gave me $7 million. They gave it to me to pay to other people.
A piece of material that you had from years ago.
Yeah.
That looked like it might not go anywhere, you were able to reintroduce it to some people.
Adapt again. I was like a dog on a bone with that story. I wanted to tell it, and then I got to tell it. And here's very full circle. Just last week at the ATX Festival in Austin, I got to screen that pilot.
You did?
Abigail Spencer from Rectify starred in that pilot.
Ah.
And we got to screen it at the festival in the sort of pilots that didn't go. And so we got to sit in the theater and watch this thing we made 13 years ago.
Wow.
We sat there crying, the two of us, just because it was like, it was like revisiting our childhoods, and it's like my boyfriend said, it was like running into an old lover where something was unresolved.
Yes.
Was what could have been. It was, you know, Abby was so good in it. She's so talented. It was so beautiful. Mm. We were so earnest. We were so young. It was really, but yes, to your point, yes, I don't ever give up on stories that sit in my
computer. No, I love that because I'm always encouraging people. Like, I'm one of those people that I don't believe in writer's block personally. Mm-hmm. And here's why. And I want, you know, you hear me talk about this all the time. Mm. I'm always like, it's like this. If you can't write today, then you can read. If you can't read, then you can listen. We have podcasts. If you can't listen, then you can watch. Right? So you have all these different things you could do.
Yes.
So if I can't write, I'm usually reading, listening, watching, or doing something that stimulates my brain cells.
Yes.
Right? And
amen.
I said, if you have a script you wrote 6 years ago, we all do, who've been writing for over 10 years, we have that script we wrote 6 years ago that never sold, right? Pull it out. I guarantee you the new you, because you learn something every day as a writer.
That's right.
Will take that script and go, oh, what if it's from the female point of view? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Oh, what if it's from that point of view, right?
Yes.
What if it's now an action movie? What if it's now a horror movie? Whatever it is, right? That's why I'm saying you should never have a day when you're not still moving forward with something.
That's right.
You know what I mean? So anyway, I don't mean that. I just wanted to piggyback
off
of that.
No, I love that. That's exactly right. I, too, don't believe in writer's block, but your reason is better than mine.
Well, of course it is.
So I was going to say, you know, for so many years I would be like, there's no such thing as writer's block. And then I realized that that may be true for me, that I have a lot of tricks that I use when I don't feel like writing. Mm-hmm. But then I've really learned
Can you tell us what those are?
Or?
Okay.
Mm. Let me tell you. I'll finish this point, and then I'll tell you that.
Good.
I really have learned to understand, which was hard for me. It's hard. You know, I feel like we all grow up thinking sort of that we think and feel much the way everybody thinks and feels. And I have figured out painfully that that's not true, and that everybody has a series of strengths and limitations and a thought process and a wiring for their brain. Mm-hmm. And it's utterly different than mine. And that writer's block is a very real thing for some people. Mm-hmm. So I really like your reason why writer's block doesn't exist, because it doesn't deny that some people have the experience of sitting down and facing terror or silence or whatever is the experience of writer's block, but it gives them permission to have that experience and then go feed their creative beast in another way. Mm-hmm. And I will say that I don't experience writer's block per se, but writer's all dried up. Like the sponge is cracked and dry and been sitting in the sun. And we used to, Shonda and I used to talk about, like, it's like we'd write and we'd write and we'd write and we'd write and we'd write. And then we'd go on hiatus and we would lie on a beach and read six books and every night watch a different movie. This is before I had a kid. you just read and you watch and then you come back and it's like the well is, it's like that sponge got dry. Into a bucket of water.
Fresh.
Got something to give again.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you have, and same for you, Tracy, do you have a script in particular, since we're talking about screenplays and TV, is there a script that you can pick up, an old one, a new one, whatever, that you read and then go, and like you could read 5 or 10 pages and be like, now I can write again. Did you have anything like that?
Like a piece of something that inspires
Or something
me?
That inspires you?
I don't think I have a thing that I can pick up and read. Yes, no, I do. I'll tell you what I read for inspiration is Anne Lamott.
All right.
Really, like Traveling Mercies, like almost any essay from her early books, Operating Instructions, Traveling Mercies. And I don't even identify as a Christian. You know, she's a spiritual, sort of liberal Christian writer, but she writes so much about... She finds the connections in the seemingly disconnected, and she finds the beauty in the ugly, and she just, I need some, what I usually need is a little dose of inspiration and faith.
Okay, that's exactly what I was tapping into for you. Yes.
Yes,
okay.
I need some faith. So for me, you know, I might go to a 12-step meeting or call a friend and talk about my idea of God, which has nothing to do with sort of the Judeo-Christian notion of God, but it's my own.
Wow.
And I might pray or I might take a walk. For me, God exists usually in conversations with friends.
Okay.
If I'm stuck or broken, I almost always call Peter Page and say, I would say to Peter, take a walk, but he doesn't like to take a walk.
Right. He doesn't like to. You can find him at the gym, though.
I can find him at the gym, but I check. We talk on the phone about whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I find spirituality and connectedness through humanity, and I have an extraordinary circle of friends who I hold very close, and that's how I usually get unstuck. It's usually through conversation with another human being. So if I can't reach a friend, or if that's not working, even the act of texting, like one of the writers in the writer's room at Shameless, and just either saying out loud or writing down
the interaction,
problem, the interaction, the reaching, the brain's reaching for an answer outside of me is often the thing that triggers the answer. Just the asking of the question. But to talk about sort of what I actually do physically when I can't write, it's a automatic writing technique that I learned in the very first writing class I ever took was when I was on the staff at the Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, which is an institute for holistic studies. And I was on the staff, and you got to take classes for free. Okay. And a teacher whose name I no longer remember because I'm so old gave us this book called Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg. And there are that... Go by that book. But in that book, there's an exercise. It's an automatic writing exercise. And it says basically like, open a book and point at a word and start on that word and set the timer for 10 minutes and free form write. Just write for 10 minutes. You don't get to stop the pen. You don't get to stop and correct spelling or punctuation. You don't get to go back and cross anything out. You have to keep your pen moving across the page for 10 minutes no matter what comes. So there's that version. The version that I use that I find really terribly helpful is is to have words that I can return to. Like, I remember... or I forgot. So I sit down and I put 10 minutes on the clock and I write, I remember. And whatever comes out, I write about that. And anytime you want to stop the pen, you go back to I remember. Because for me, without something to go back to, it gets a little nebulous. But if I'm saying, you know, I'm looking at this Reese's peanut butter cup and it's like, I remember the first time I tried a Reese's peanut butter cup. I was on the beach. I was seven. I was living in Venice and my mom was in some kind of rage and I had run down the beach by myself. And I remember that the ocean was pouring onto the sand. And I remember, and you just write and write and write and it stirs. It's a peanut butter cup, but suddenly you're in like you're really painful loneliness from childhood.
And that
childhood.
Was visual, too. Wasn't it? Didn't you? I saw every move you made right there.
And they saw me. I closed my eyes and I did it like I was writing. Like the pen is moving. It's a way, it tricks the critic out of your brain. It tricks the desire to get it right out of your brain. It reminds you that writing is about flow and truth and that you have stories to tell. And when I teach this class, which I sometimes do, I go back to the Omega Institute once a year and teach, and I give them a focal point, which is, think about a time you were lost or think about a time you were found. And then use the words I remember. And I mean, people, we just sit there and weep. Like what comes to people is extraordinary. And the key is not stopping the pen. The key is not allowing the editor
in. It becomes
in.
This cathartic.
Yes.
Great tools that all the writers use. I'm sure. Oh, for me, if it's something specific that I'm working on in a script, like we talked about, Shane Black, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, another podcast, there may be a screenplay or a teleplay that I'll look at if I'm working on something very specifically. But if it's about inspiration and just trying to get recharged and back in, there are crime novels, Elmore Leonard, Richard Price in particular, George Pelicanos, all his books are set in D.C. Like those are the people who did it for me. I started out as a novelist before I got into screenwriting and television. So certain, like those writers really make me remember why I wanted to do this and what was cool about it and their genius. Even a Terry McMillan at time or B.B. Moore Campbell, some of these great novels that came out in the 90s. But so there's certain writers I can refer, Walter Mosley, I can refer to them.
Are there passages you find that you look for? Or you could just open it up and just go?
Well, they're so good, I just trust the book.
Yeah.
Even now. And this is not an endorsement. Richard Price's latest novel is called The Whites. It's a disgraced New York detective. There was like this elite squad of detectives 20 years ago or something. They've all kind of moved on. And they all have a case that haunted them. like the worst of the bad guys, one of them got away. And so they're all obsessed with their own bad guy who escaped. Mm-hmm. And all these bad guys get together to get back at these six cops who are former partners. It's brilliant.
It's a premise.
It's insane. Yeah. But just thinking about it, like, I'm excited to get back and finish it.
Yeah. I see where you're going.
Or Pelicanos, people who wrote about places where I grew up, mm-hmm. New York or D.C., mm-hmm. And that time. So that does it for me. Every time I read those books or go back to them, I'm ready to either get on to something new or dig up something I worked on.
You feel
on
like
before.
You can write an Oscar or something, you know, after you read some of those things. And I think that's what I'm looking for when you're in your, I don't mean to take up your time, when you're in your moment of I can't write.
Yes.
You pull out that thing that makes you feel like you can again. You
or that
I mean?
Makes you want to try again.
Try again,
for
sure.
For me, Jonathan Franzen.
Oh, all right.
Like,
that's
when I sit
one.
Down and read those books, I am a better writer for having read them. I am a better writer for having read them. Yeah. Right now, I am almost painfully obsessed with Hamilton and the lyrics.
Come on now.
In terms of inspiration.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
How does a bastard orphan,
son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence and providence and teller, go up to be a hero and a scholar, girl? Y'all don't even know.
You have to give credit.
Y'all are slipping on this musical.
You have to give credit where credit is due.
He's
that musical.
The thing about that musical and Lin-Manuel Miranda as a public figure. I don't mm-hmm. know him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to because I don't like to meet my heroes.
Oh, you one of those?
Wow.
Yes, I know what you're talking about.
It's just I am so moved I could cry because mm-hmm. it's not just his majesty, his genius with mm-hmm. the word. It's his generosity. Of spirit mm-hmm. as a figure, the way he brings in kids for free to watch that show, the mm-hmm. way he was a seventh grade teacher, that sonnet he wrote for the Tonys, the fact that he wrote, this is what's blowing my mind this week because I just got it. I'm not an obsessive fan either. Mm-hmm. Like the last thing I was obsessive about was Les Mis. I was so obsessive that I named my daughter Cosette. Her name
really?
Is
Cosette.
Wow.
Like, that's cute.
The one before that was Andrew McCarthy in high school. Like, I'm not historically an obsessive fan, but I'm so affected by Hamilton and Lin-Manuel that
you have
I
got
have
to listen to this.
I have to, like, slowly give myself pieces. So I just got the mm-hmm. Hamilton. And the fact that I can open this thing, because sometimes I sit and I listen to it and I'm intimidated mm-hmm. as a writer. I'm like, what the actual fuck? Mm-hmm. How did he rhyme those words?
Yes.
You know, and it's really like it's crippled me. I write songs sometimes too mm-hmm. and I'm like, I can't even try to rhyme. I can't even try. But then he wrote this book he's notated the lyrics and talked about who he was referencing, you know.
I was going to order this.
Rap star. This is a reference to this classic musical mm-hmm. theater piece. Or
very generous.
Yes. Very generous. Yes. But with the thing that's most amazing to me about it and has been a huge gift is that he wrote things like, it took me more than a year to write this verse.
Yes.
It took me more than a year to write this verse. This song took years. He wrote that thing for 6 or 7 years.
It took him that long.
And so now I look at that verse, which is actually the verse that blows my fucking mind.
Flawless.
I imagine death so much it feels more like a memory. How about just that sentence?
Yeah, yeah.
But then it goes on from there. You know, is it going to mm-hmm. get, when's it going to get me? Is it 7 mm-hmm. feet ahead of me? Mm-hmm. I could do it mm-hmm. if I went back. But it's like, you're like, what is happening? Like, how did he
write
these
things? I'm not throwing away my shot.
How did he do this? Well, he did it because he worked on it for 2 fucking years.
Mm-hmm.
And as a writer, the breath that brings in of like, oh my God, I never work on anything for 2 years.
right.
I never do that.
You give yourself a little break.
Definitely.
It's like, oh, the genius to which I aspire is not pretending that he called that in after a fever dream. Mm-hmm. He is telling the truth.
Right.
I worked on that for 2 years. The generosity, the miracle, the gift, the inspiration, that's mm-hmm. everything. I'm super grateful.
Very cool.
I love that.
So you get to L.A., with your Portland crew, because mm-hmm. I know who listens to this podcast.
It's all right.
They're following. So is there a transition as far as starting to write? We got the agent at the small lit agency, the assistant. So take us to what happens from there.
I actually think this is mostly aspiring writers, right?
So I have showrunners listen to this.
All right, okay. Well, let me take a minute and tell you about right before I got the agent, when I moved to L.A. When I moved to L.A., I had written comedy specs. That's what I had been doing while I was in Portland. Mm-hmm. I had written an episode of Friends. I had written an episode of Mad About You. Really? I had written a Just Shoot Me. I had written a couple pilots. This is what I was doing. Okay. And I moved to L.A., and people read my scripts, and it was like this friend of a friend and that friend of a friend from the theater community in mm-hmm. Portland, and this person who sold one piece of writing, and this person who's running this show. Like, it was like, I say I didn't have contacts because I didn't have like pedigree, mm-hmm. but what I had was a theater community who were incredibly generous with their willingness to call and say, I love Krista. Will you read her? And theater people are generous and willing to try to help other
That's
theater
where I come
people.
From, theater.
And so some people read me, and what I got back three times, and it's like, you know, I think it's William Goldman who says, like, if you get the note one time, maybe you can ignore it, but once you've gotten it three times, you have to pay attention. Mm-hmm. I got told not funny enough.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. And that was extremely painful for me. And I had worked so hard. It had taken me like 6 months to write that Friends spec. Wow. And I felt like I knew those characters inside and out. And I felt like, what do you mean it's not funny enough? Three times. And what I finally understood, people kept saying, your character work is incredible, but you're not a half hour writer. Try hour long. And I didn't want to try hour long because I only watched ER, and I was like, what am I going to, you know, I watched ER and Law and Order, and I was like, I'm going to write the law. I'm going to write the medicine. Like, there was barely an internet, you guys. Like, what was I going to look stuff
up? Right. Right.
And so I was sort of devastated. But what I figured out later is that I wasn't willing to throw away what I thought to be true about the characters in order to plant a laugh out loud joke three a page. Mm-hmm. Truth was more important to me. Mm-hmm. And so people would, I'd look at these scripts and I'd be like, I don't think Phoebe would say that, but it made me laugh really hard, but I don't think she would say it, so I wouldn't have written it.
Got it.
Sitcom writers care, they care, the thing that's the most important is the funny.
The funny.
That's what's most important. Of course. And I'm not that writer. Yep. And so I got told to try hour long, which meant it felt like all this work was wasted. No work is ever wasted, but it felt that way. And so I sat down, and Felicity had just premiered, and I watched the first five episodes of Felicity, and I thought, well, that I can write. I couldn't write Law and Order. I didn't think, ironically, it was my first assignment was Law and Order. But I could write Felicity. I understood that girl. That's, you know, was only a couple years older, and so I spec'd a Felicity in 4 days.
Wow.
See, we hear these stories all the time. And those are always the ones that get you, too. You're like, you just put the pedal to the metal.
That is, it took me 6 months to write a spec of Friends and 4 days to write a Felicity. Now, that won't be true for everybody, but for me, the clarity of, oh, this is my, those people who I thought were so mean and hurtful and saying I'm not funny enough and saying try this other thing saved me, because also those half hour writers rooms, they work late. I don't need that. I'm tired. So I wrote a Felicity, and then I turned it into this agent who, this friend of a friend of a friend. And she said, it's great. We need one more. And I said, what should I write? And she said, The Practice. Now, this was before TiVo. So I went to the Broadcast Museum in Beverly Hills. I'd never seen The Practice. I watched 12 episodes of The Practice, and then I wrote a practice spec in 8 days.
Wow.
So it was very much like, oh, this is what I do. This is what I do. And then within almost a month of turning that around, those agents got me a meeting with Renee Balsay at Law & Order, who gave me my first freelance assignment.
What are those? We don't have those anymore, too.
Yes. I know. Those don't really exist anymore, but that was my entree. Mm-hmm. And that same season, I staffed on Time of Your Life, which was a Kaiser Lippmann spinoff of Party of Five, Jennifer Love Hewitt, and Jennifer Garner in New York. And from there, I went to Charmed for 3 years. And then I was told that I
swear I run into so many writers who used to work on Charmed. Like, everybody comes through Charmed somehow. It's like that 6 degrees of separation.
Brad Kern
or some
had
shit.
An eye for talent. Mm-hmm. A lot of almost everybody I was on staff with there is now a showrunner. Yes. So, and he was a great teacher. Mm-hmm. He is a great teacher. Mm-hmm. So, I I did Charmed for three seasons, and then I was told that I was going to be pigeonholed as like a girl sci-fi writer, even though I had never written a single sci-fi thing or watched a single sci-fi thing before I got hired at Charmed. Brad hired me off like my practice spec.
Really?
His thing was like, I don't need sci-fi writers. I need great writers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then there are these rules. Mm-hmm. And so I was like pigeonholed as a, as like a sci-fi girl. So I wrote that year my dad died, and I put that pain to
she went
paper,
personal.
Put a pencil to my temple, connected to my brain, and I wrote my first refrain, a testament to my pain. I wrote Hamilton. I wrote a play about my dad's death, and that got me, actually, ironically, here I was trying not to be pigeonholed in fantasy and sci-fi, and that play got me hired at Wonder Falls.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. And then Wonder Falls was canceled after 13. Shonda was a Charmed fan. So Shonda read my play and loved Charmed. And so I went in to meet her. Here's a story, though, for other writers. I had a terrible time at Wonder Falls. I couldn't write it.
Okay.
You know, not every good writer can write every TV show.
Totally.
And that's the simple truth. The art of television is about suspending your own voice largely and writing in the voice of the show.
Sure.
And I couldn't. Brian Fuller is his own kind of genius, and it is a different kind of genius than mine. If I have, you know, speaking of genius.
You're a genius, girl. You're a genius.
Speaking of genius in the terms of, in the Liz Gilbert term, which is like, it's, or in the old Greek or Roman term, which is like the genius comes to visit you, and it's like a little being in the corner who sometimes shows up. Brian's and mine, the Who Visit, they are not cousins. They are not related. His sense of humor, I said to him in my meeting when he interviewed me, I said, this script is a kind of funny to which I aspire. And that, I realized, is not your job in TV. That shouldn't be your job. I kept aspiring, and I kept failing, and I kept getting rewritten, and I was miserable. And I said to my agent, I need to go write a show that my voice matches. I can't do this again next year. It's too painful. And I read it was called Surgeons. It was called like the Untitled Surgeon Show. And I read it, and I called my agent, and I said, if I didn't know better, I would think I wrote this in a fever dream. Like, it, our voices, it was like, oh, God, this I can do. And he said, you know, that pilot has no heat. It's Patrick Dempsey. He's a pilot killer. I think we should be really focused on something else.
And Patrick Dempsey couldn't get arrested.
And I said, I would like to meet anyway. I want to meet anyway. And so I met with Shonda, and then we talked about American Idol for 45 minutes.
Really?
We talked about Kelly Clarkson and LaToya.
That was that year.
That was that year.
Yes.
And then we worked together for the next 7 years.
Wow.
And that obviously was a career change.
So was that the show you started really moving up?
Yes. Became the co-showrunner, I think season two.
You better go, girl.
I think it was season two. It might have been season three, but I think it was season two. And that's because my voice matched hers, and she could walk in and go, help, do, and that is everything to have a writer who can, you know, when you're show running, it's really, unbelievably hard. And there are
Let's talk about it. Since we got you here, let's talk about the writer's room and show running and things that you learned. Let's get into it. Tell us.
Okay. What do you want to know?
Tell us, for instance, like, what are some of the things that, I know you can't be specific, but like, what's a writer's room look like with Shonda? What's a writer's room look like on Shameless, for instance?
At Grey's Anatomy, Jim Perriott was Shonda's co-showrunner, season one, and, she was new to TV. She'd written like Introducing Dorothy Dandridge and things, and she'd written one other TV pilot. So in the beginning, what it looked like with Shonda, and she's told that she's talked about this publicly, is that she would stand in the door and sort of shiver and go crazy and be like, why am I supposed to go in there and talk to those people? Like, she was a movie writer. She was used to being alone with her pain. So she would sort of linger in the doorway, just bewildered by the whole situation. And so Jim set the sort of parameters that I've actually, now I'm hearing that Shondaland is doing some things differently. But in the mm-hmm. beginning, for the first 7 years, it was, you know, it's a 40-hour a week room, mm-hmm. and it's collaborative. Everybody sits around, and somebody has the pen. Whoever sort of episode it is holds the pen, and mm-hmm. you fill up the board with beats, and you talk mm-hmm. about everything. Mm-hmm. The showrunner comes in, and you pitch it down. You know, Shonda would come in, we'd pitch it down to her. She would tell us what she liked and what she didn't like, and give some suggestions of what she'd like in lieu of what she didn't like, and then we would erase some beats and do it again, and then you send the writer off to outline after anywhere between, you know, I don't know, 2 and 5 days on the board with the mm-hmm. story. Mm-hmm. So that's a very standard hour-long mm-hmm. old-school television.
Sure.
You know, you do 40 to 50
Well, Jim's
hours.
From that older...
Jim is from that, yeah. And I had grown up with Brad Kern teaching me that okay. same thing. So mm-hmm. when Jim was gone and it was me, it was the same thing. Mm-hmm. Now I understand that at Scandal there's like group writing and they're doing different things, but and Shonda is very, like, she's very good at hiring very talented people and
the best.
Delegating yes. and defer. She's not super deferential, but collaborating. She's okay. she really is, and that was the joy for me in those early years of Grey's Anatomy. Is as crazy as it sounds, like Shonda and I would just shout at each other, shout, and you know, act scenes out, and you know, there were things she wanted to do that I thought were super crazy, and I would yell at her, and there were things that I would write or want to do that she was like, "That's great," and she would yell at me, and then I feel like if one of us was red and one of us was yellow, those early years of the show, it was orange. You know, we found this color that it lived. You know, Shonda is very, like, her sensibilities are dark and dramatic. She often mm-hmm. wanted to kill people.
Really?
And I come from such a dark and dramatic childhood, honestly, mm-hmm. which I apply at Shameless. But mm-hmm. I was like, I want some butterflies and sunshine. I don't want to kill. Can we not kill that kid?
That's
what if
hilarious.
He grows up and lives happily ever after in this hour of TV? And then we would find the tension between mm-hmm. those two things.
Okay.
And, mm-hmm. And it was tremendous creatively.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to do a huge amount of writing in those early years. Mm-hmm. And that was tremendous for me as, like, in terms of, like, you see, like, you talk about Peter's at the gym. I don't mm-hmm. go to the gym, which is mm-hmm. why I won't let you take pictures of me today. But but I, when I started at Grey's Anatomy, I could write somewhere between 7 and 9 pages in a day. And mm-hmm. that was a lot. That I,
yeah,
I
yeah.
worked
That's
up
a
to
ton.
That. And by the time I left Grey's Anatomy, I remember that my personal record was 39 pages in a day.
Wow.
That's what you sometimes
That's
have to do when you're doing 22
yeah.
episodes
yeah.
of TV.
You writing TV, you got to have some speed.
You are chasing some
yeah.
shit.
Yeah.
They are waiting on those mm-hmm. pages, and you need to write that shit.
Yeah.
And Shonda is not afraid to come in and say, "You guys, I woke up in the middle of the night and I realized that
no.
those two characters can't do that thing," upon which the next 6 episodes turn. And it's like,
right.
and I love that. I it makes it really super hard.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I'd so prefer that than I've worked with people who are like, it's going to be too much work. Even though you're
yeah.
going, no, it's wrong. We're not going to pull that thread.
Mm-hmm.
Shonda will pull that thread, and then
it
we
shows.
All will get together and try to knit a new rug.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the experience there.
Okay. What was it like leaving the show for you? Was it?
It was very painful.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been there for 7 years,
mm-hmm.
But I wrote a pilot that got
mm-hmm.
made, Grace,
mm-hmm.
Which was about dancers, and I loved it. And I made it, and I thought it was going to go to series, and I trained my replacements at Grey's Anatomy, who I adore, my dear friends Joan Rader
mm-hmm.
and Tony Phelan, who now have Doubt at CBS.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, we had a cupcake party, and we exchanged a lot of heartfelt emails. But, you know, Shonda made us T-shirts week 1 of Grey's Anatomy that was like her motto for the show, which said, "No hugging, no crying, no secret pain."
Really?
That was the motto. That was the That's what made Grey's Anatomy
That's
different in the beginning
yeah.
From other medical shows, is no hugging, no crying, no secret pain. Like everybody
that.
Is a little bit
mm-hmm.
edgy and a little bit caustic and a little bit broken. And And so there was not a lot of hugging, crying, or secret pain when I left Grey's Anatomy, but there were emails later, like weeks later when we could all, it was hard. It's like leaving it's like graduating from college. Sure. It's like, these are your people and you want to stay, but for you, it's over, even though all your best friends maybe are in the classes behind you and you want to stay, but it would hold you back to stay. So you go and you grieve. And,
so were you stuck, like, after the pilot didn't get picked up? Were you like, well, should I go back, or like, what was going on?
After the pilot didn't get picked up, Shonda, had wanted me for many years to go to Grayson, to private practice.
Oh,
she, you'll see that I wrote some episodes of Private while I was on Grey's because she, we loved each other and I got her voice and she wanted me to go do that on that other show. And I kept saying no, cause I really preferred Grey's and I have a problem with mothers and babies who are sick and dying. And there was too much of that on private practice. And so, after Grace didn't go, I had gone, you guys, this is like a story of counting your chickens before they hatch. Mm-hmm. Everyone was so high on it that I flew myself to New York. Like, I was like, we're going to those upfronts. And so my daughter and I went to Omega that week. I was teaching writing and I was waiting for the call. I had my clothes for New York for the upfronts and I got the wrong call.
Like, we
gonna
get it.
Oh,
really?
So I called my friend Annie, who's Coco's, who at the time was like our housemaid and best friend and babysitter, and she flew and picked up Coco and flew her home, and I went to the airport with them and got on a plane to Rome.
Really?
I was like,
I'm taking a vacation.
Fucking broken. I have too many miles that I have saved up for all the years I've been running the show. I am tired, and I have money, and I'm going somewhere. And I went to Rome.
Where am I 10%?
No, I don't. But I went to Rome. That's where I did, and I ate a lot. Mm-hmm. And it was a super painful time because I also went with an ex-boyfriend. Like, I'd broken up with somebody, but I was like, me. Like, let's go to Rome and have a lot of sex and eat a lot of pizza. But I was like something out of Eat, Pray, Love.
Right.
Like, he was not in love with me anymore. And so I was like crying, like literally on the floor, grieving the relationship, the end of Grey's Anatomy and the pilot. No joke.
Wow.
Biting a towel, sobbing while he slept in the hotel room bed, like on the floor of the bathroom. It was a really
all is lost moment.
It was very all is lost.
It's crazy.
And while I was there, I got an email from my agent saying, Shonda wants to know if you want to come to private practice.
Really?
And I didn't want to come to private practice. I just wanted to keep crying.
Mm-hmm.
But it was familiar. Shonda as a boss was familiar. Mm-hmm. And I said, I will do it for this much money. And if I can do it from home, because I wanted to be with my kid and the years of Grey's Anatomy were really hard to be a mom. Yeah. The hours were really long and I wanted to be with Coco. And so Shonda said yes. And that was for the next 2 years, I got to collect a salary and work from home and I would note outlines and note scripts and rewrite them
That's
from home.
Amazing.
It was really a tremendous,
but the relationship, obviously, with you and Shonda, the history was there. So it was
the
history's
there. She
surprise.
Knew she could rely on me. And just, they didn't even use me that much in those years. But I think for Shonda, knowing that there was someone who she could call
Shonda and I,
for some reason, it's like we could just finish each other's sentences from the beginning, even though we were super different. We had a shorthand very quickly. And so for Shonda to know that there was a writer who she could send a script to and go, fix this, please, and that I was honest, it worked out beautifully because I had a lot of grieving to do. My marriage had ended the year before. I had a lot of grieving to do.
Yeah.
And
thank you for being so honest, man. I appreciate it. That is real. This is real shit.
Yeah, well,
for
you said we were keeping it real.
That's real shit.
I needed to cry a lot.
Yeah.
I needed to cry a lot.
Yeah.
And so I worked from home and I wrote for Shonda and I developed some pilots and I took my kid to school and it was great. And then after a couple of years, I actually think that was, I stayed with Private those 2 years and then it was done.
Mm-hmm.
Private was done and I was on Shameless. And so.
Now, how did that one come to you?
So now by this point in a career, even by this year, your phone rings and they go, they're hiring at Shameless. I still had to interview for the job, but it's less of a, where's my next job going to come from? And more of a, what am I willing to, you've saved a little bit of money and it's like, what am I going to sell my time for? It's like,
right.
if I could be with my kid, right now at this age, what am I going to, what, how many hours of my life am I going to sell? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
And yeah. It's hours for dollars, it's very real.
And so they called about Shameless. And like I said, I was like, no, I'm not staffing. Like, I'm super happy. I had taken up the guitar.
Really?
I was sitting at, I was like working on my calluses and, you know, writing from home for Shonda. And this call came, and my agent, who's known me for all of my career, said, watch it. Just watch the show. And I had the flu that weekend, and so I watched, no joke, like 20 episodes of Shameless over the weekend.
I binged that show. Whenever I get backed up, we just watch it.
Yeah. And I called my agent on Monday, and I was like, okay, I'll take the meeting. So I went in to meet John, and in that meeting, he told me that he kept a 9-hour-a-week writer's room.
What?
He keeps a 9-hour-a-week writer's room on Shameless. And I was like, I'll take it. Like, they offered me the job. I was like,
Okay. You got to tell her, how does that work?
So that is, you don't end up as a writer working fewer hours. You just work more of them on your own and from home, which for me, which for many writers who are in TV, that's, they wouldn't want to be on that. They they want the writer's room.
Mm-hmm.
But I, with, you know, my priority being my kid, and now I was a single mom, and you know what I mean? Like, it was like, oh, I only have to go to the office 9 hours a week. And writers aren't on set.
Are they not?
Whereas in Shondaland, you're on the set producing your episode. John doesn't have the writers on set. Yeah. So it's literally, it's 9 hours. Like, I'm so lucky, you guys.
Man.
I'm so lucky. I'm so blessed. Mm-hmm. So I got to go. I joined that staff season 3, and now we're in season 7.
Mm-hmm.
One of the years I didn't go because I was making 2 pilots. But but the way that works is that we have general conversations about the show, and John fills up sort of your book. It's like you've got episode 701, 702, 703, and you've got a sentence or two for Lip and a sentence or two for Fiona. Like, one year my story for Lip said, Lip does manual labor. That's what it said on the board.
Really?
And we joke about this all the time. I went home and I was like, Lip does manual labor. But there had been half an hour of discussion on that story in the room that the writer's assistant had written down diligently. And so she sends you all the notes. And really what's happened there is John has told his stories from the summers that he did manual labor.
Those are great episodes.
Right? And so you're looking at, but you go away more like a playwright and you break a story by yourself. That's how it works. So you're, like I said, you're not working fewer hours.
And not easy breaking a story by yourself.
It is not easy breaking a story by yourself. And what ends up happening is that you write an outline, and that the way that we would fill the board, and we'd have been in the room talking about it for a week, and the beats would be laid out, and we would pitch it to Shonda. That first outline is like the first board pitch.
Okay.
So you end up writing several outlines.
Okay.
You end up writing a lot more in Shameless. Right. But you end up with a huge, much more autonomy. You're like, you feel like that story, I gave birth to that story. Whereas in a more collaborative writer's room, it feels more like everybody did that story.
Mm-hmm.
So there's pros and there's cons to to both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Also at Shameless, we all read and note every outline and script. Even when John writes an outline or script, he puts his own stuff through the same process, which is there's 6 writers at the table and everybody has read and noted everything.
That makes sense.
Now, most shows, when you're in the writer's room 40 hours a week or 50 hours a week, you don't have the hours to read and note every script and outline that comes in. So usually, it was my job, for example, at Grey's Anatomy, I would only be in the room maybe 10 hours a week. I would sort of keep, I'd come in, I'd direct it, I'd pitch a thing, and then I'd go, because I was reading and noting every script and outline in order to get it ready for Shonda.
Right.
So it's a different, it's collaborative in a different way. And you end up with everybody's sort of notes and thoughts after you've put a whole bunch of stuff on paper.
Okay.
And John sort of sits there and goes, you know, I thought on page 7 you should do X. And you might go, oh, really? I had a note there too, and it's Y. And then you'll say, no, I think it should be Z. And John will go, no, he's right, it's Y. You know what I mean? And and so he's happy for someone to beat his note.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And or sometimes he'll be like, no, do it my way.
Very thorough.
It's totally different, and both are totally collaborative. And for most of my career, I would say that I would have preferred the Shondaland way, for lack of a better term, the sort of old school way,
right.
Because I like to talk to people clearly. Yeah. I haven't shut up since I
you're doing great, girl. Awesome.
I like to talk, and I like to talk, and I like to listen, and it's harder to sit home alone and write it like it's a play. John hires a lot of playwrights. There's a lot of playwrights on that staff. Sheila Callahan, Dominique Morisseau.
It shows. I mean, the writing, the acting. I mean, the writing is just so clean and so real in the way that you hear that. Oh, it's got to just write real. Like, no, motherfucker. Well, there's an art to this.
Yeah. I think it's a simple thing. We were talking about our excitement for Shameless earlier, and it does remind me. You mentioned the Party of Five spinoff. Party of Five back in the day, similar. Well, you know, it's like multiple siblings. You know, no real parents. But it's like, it's not just the only similarity. I like that show too. Before I knew anything about actual writing, I was like, these people have problems. Like, they have real issues. I think it's that simple in many respects. Like, and Shameless is brilliant because. The episode opens, you know, it's always morning, you know, it's getting ready for the day. Mm-hmm. And you know there's going to be some crazy shit she has to deal with.
And it's always stylized the way they do it. Too.
Before you know, nightfall. So it's remarkable in that, and you noted, like, the realness, the dimension, the depths of those issues. Like, Deb's issues in school, like, we all know what it's like to be bullied or not fitting in. We know that person. We've seen that. But so much of it is so well done that you just kind of have to give it up. So I thought about Party of Five. It's funny that you mentioned the spinoff because they had issues too.
They had issues. And the primary difference is that for whatever reason, they had issues without humor. Like Party of Five was very, very earnest.
Right.
And my experience of life, anyway, is that the darker it gets, the funnier it gets.
For sure.
And that is why I love writing Shameless, is I get to bring that.
You know, at the heart of Shameless to me, and I talk about this a lot, me and my husband will be watching an episode or something, and we'll be binging like two or three of them in a row, and I'll say something like, you know what's funny? They never miss the theme. They always come back to me, like, Lip and why am I going blank on the redheaded brother?
Ian.
And Ian can get into a fist fight. Mm-hmm. And at the end, if somebody else came in, they both would jump on them. You know what I mean?
Right.
It never gets away from the theme of family, period.
Right.
It always comes back to, we may appear to hate each other, but I will freaking cross the moon for my brothers and sisters. Right. You know what I mean? It's always there. Every week. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Smart. It's smart. It's smart.
It's fun to write.
Are you looking forward to anything that you've developed now? Do you have a favorite child in that group? Or is there anything that happened with Grace that informs you doing things differently now? Or do you just...
So I've made five pilots. I've been blessed to get to make five pilots. I've written seven or eight, and I've gotten to make five of
those.
That
was great odds.
Nice.
Yes. And I've been waiting for the one that will go to series, but the blessing of getting to make five, while there's high highs and low lows, and it's painful, like it's like when it doesn't go, it breaks your heart. But I feel like I've had unpaid grad school in terms of, because the show running and producing a pilot is a different beast than anything else that you do. Anything else that you do, except it's like, maybe if you are writing and directing and producing an independent film in a ridiculously short period of time because you have a really low budget, that's the only thing I can equate what happens in the pilot making process.
Okay.
And so I've gotten to do it five times. So there was Lenny Rose, there was Grace, and then I made something called Rita for Bravo. I made Songbird for E, and a couple years ago I made Studio City for Fox. And I feel like I have a graduate degree now. What works and what doesn't, and why and how, and it's been extraordinary, and so I've got a couple of things in development that I love deeply. And that I have hopes for. Although I try not to let my hopes get too high.
Right.
I'm an optimist by nature, but that's all. It's a long way to fall when you're like, that is going. Yeah. Now I try to be in the blessing of getting to do it.
Yeah.
You get to be like putting on a play. Like mm-hmm. when you make a play, it's not going to go for 5 years. I mean, Hamilton's going to go forever. But usually better. You're going to do it for 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And so being in it and getting to make the play and getting to be with other artists, that's the gift.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so often in Hollywood, we lose sight of the gift of the present because it's about what's it going to become or what's it going to earn or how many seasons is going to go. And I mean, I've gotten to work with unbelievable talent. Mm-hmm. And so I've got a project called Best of Both Worlds, which is based on a Paul Abbott miniseries from 10 years ago. Paul mm-hmm. Abbott created Shameless in England. Mm-hmm. And it's a miniseries about a woman who's a flight attendant who travels between two different cities. In my version, she travels between Los Angeles and Paris. Hmm. And she
That's
has
not
a,
bad.
A husband. Exactly. My boyfriend's French, you guys.
I think she made...
Here we go.
You know, very convenient there, Krista.
Casually, I love Paris. She lives in Los Angeles with her husband and her two kids who she's been married to her husband for 20 years. She has a very real grounded life here with in-laws and mm-hmm. kids. And she gets on the plane and she goes to Paris where you realize she has another husband.
I'm interested in getting to tell stories,
letting women be as complex as men have historically been allowed to be in television.
Nice.
That's my calling. That's my, mm-hmm. that's what I want to do. And so I love Best of Both Worlds and I have other things that are more in fledgling stages right now. So I won't tell you what they're about.
But, all right.
You shared a lot.
Yes.
I'll totally watch Best of Both Worlds.
Yes.
Right?
It's a little, Up in the Air with George Clooney.
Yeah.
And Vera Farmiga. Yeah, yeah.
They had that little
twist. That came to mind for me.
Yeah,
she had a husband and he didn't know it, right?
Right.
She was having an affair.
When he showed up at her door.
Yeah. So, oh, shit.
I hope you get some of that.
Oh, shit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, well, for me, just, I love the affair. I mean, just as a fan.
It's fantastic. Slow. But it's not slow. Everybody keeps saying it's slow. I'm
it
like,
pays
no,
off.
I think, you know,
I don't
there,
think
there
it
are
is.
People I work with who are like, it's melodramatic. And I'm like, excuse me, but affairs and divorces are fucking melodramatic.
Yes.
And don't tell me otherwise.
Yes,
right. I think it's so powerful what mm-hmm. they're doing. And so I was pitching actually Best of Both Worlds before The Affair came on, and then I was watching The Affair, and it was like I actually had to shape mine away from The Affair.
Oh.
So I had written, actually, talk about writing and rewriting and rewriting mm-hmm. and rewriting. I had met with a major movie star trying to attach her to the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to see a script, and my people were like, Krista Vernoff doesn't spec scripts, and I was like, guess what? I'm going to go to a hotel for 4 days and write it for this major talent because...
You can.
What? Who doesn't do... I have no patience mm-hmm. for people who are like, I'm offer only. I'm not going to audition mm-hmm. for that. What? You're an artist. You mm-hmm. are highly paid and you are getting to work with the people of your dreams. Mm-hmm. Sit the fuck down and do some work for free because mm-hmm. we get to participate.
Yeah.
So I went and I wrote it. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is what I think it is. Mm-hmm. And in the pilot, she was... It was a more of an origins story.
Mm-hmm.
It was I was trying to show how a woman makes the decision to embark on an affair that leads to a second marriage. And I was doing it all sort of in an hour. So there mm-hmm. were flashbacks and her sister had died and she was in shock and I was doing all of these things. Well, then that major movie star moved on to something mm-hmm. else and didn't attach. And then we sold the pitch at HBO. and in the meantime, The Affair had premiered.
Mm-hmm.
And now I had to completely reboot it. Because I didn't want it to look like The Affair.
Right, right.
So I revealed in, you know, on page 10 that she was married, which actually makes it way edgier and more HBO, mm-hmm. where you're like, you're not seeing mm-hmm. how it happened.
Right.
You're in it, and you're like, what the fuck?
Right.
Like, she's got two sets of wedding rings.
Mm-hmm.
But the willingness, I think it's super important for success and for ongoing success to be willing always mm-hmm. to reinvent and to not get too defeated when something you put a lot of time and energy into. Like I remember I spec'd a movie that I called Starstruck in the there before I was working as a TV writer. Mm-hmm. And the day that I finished it and had my actor friends over to my living room to read it to me, it was about a movie star, the biggest movie star in the world, and he fell in love with a British small town woman who didn't know who he was.
Hmm.
And the day I finished it, the first ad for Notting Hill played.
Yes.
Wow. And I called my boyfriend hyperventilating. He hyperventilating so much that he thought something had happened to one of the kids I was babysitting.
Really?
Because I had spent 2 years writing it. Mm-hmm. And it was so close to Notting Hill, it was shocking.
Wow.
That happens to all of us.
All
it
of
happens
us.
To everybody.
All of us.
And you cannot be like, I'm going to sue. You can't be like, it's
nope.
the zeitgeist.
It's in the air,
it
Jack.
Is what it is. Yep. And you go, okay, and you put it away and you write something else. And or you reinvent.
Yeah.
You
take
know?
It from another point of view.
You have to. We're so privileged to be free and artists mm-hmm. and in this city. Mm-hmm. And I would say to any artists, any writers who are listening to this and don't live in this city, but they want to be in TV mm-hmm. or movies, move here.
Yeah.
You have to move here. If you want to be a politics, you have to move, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like don't not move to LA if you want to be in TV and movies. Is it possible? Yes. Are you radically limiting your opportunities? Mm-hmm. Yes. Are you listening to somebody who's telling you not to chase your dreams or that it's too risky? Mm-hmm. Fuck them. Everything is too risky. Fuck that noise.
Talk about it.
Uh-huh. Move to Los Angeles.
You got to be honest with yourself. Yeah. You can't, you know, there's a price to pay.
Chase your dreams, goddammit. What is this life for?
Yeah.
Pack a fucking bag, put it in a car. I slept in my car when I moved to Portland. I was sleeping in my car with my boyfriend.
How bad do you want it?
How bad do you want it? Mm-hmm. And if you don't want it that bad, great. Go have a different career.
Yes.
If there's something else you could be happy doing, do that.
Mm-hmm.
If you are not comfortable with high highs and low lows, if you're allergic, don't have a career in this business or become an executive.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's what you want and what you think about and what you dream about, keep writing and fucking move to Los Angeles and do it.
That's it.
It's the number one email that I get from listeners, and we are all over the world in over 80-something countries. How do I move there? Should I move? Who means should you move here? Damn it, yes, you need to get here, especially if you want to do TV, you know?
It's that maybe it's because I grew up on welfare and living in a – my mom kept a lease on a house in Venice Beach that had 4 bedrooms, and she rented out – or it had 5, but she rented out 4 of the bedrooms to other artists, so we didn't pay any rent. Like, there was a huge amount of resourcefulness, but I didn't come from anything. And so I was willing to sleep in my car or sleep on somebody's sofa or sleep in a hostel.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't, like, somehow beneath me, and I didn't have any expectation of safety or security.
Entitlement,
I didn't have any entitlement. I also didn't need... Like, I remember somebody said to me something about a starter car or a starter house. And I was raised by hippies. I hadn't even heard those terms. Like, thank God.
Mm-hmm,
I wasn't raised by people for whom stability was the primary goal.
Mm-hmm.
And so you won't have a lot of stability in your early years of aspiring screenwriting.
Yeah, sure.
Let go of the need if you want to do this. Let go of that need, because the rewards are so tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
When you push past the need for ease or stability or an expected path. And the joy of getting to just be in a city that's all artists who all want to be artists is, I mean, you're also with, like, the prettiest girl from every high school in the world, so you have to just put on blinders. Yes. But, just like, why wouldn't you chase your dreams?
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah. On that note,
absolutely.
Thank you very much, Krista.
Thank you so
much. That was
much.
Awesome.
Thank you. This was
awesome.
Fun.
I had a ball.
Yeah. You shared so a lot. This is going to be a jewel.
It's going to be a great one. It's coming out tomorrow, girl.
Awesome.
Yeah. I'm putting this out. Think I'm Not. It's jumping out tomorrow.
For sure.
Krista Vernoff. Is it Vernoff?
Yeah, Vernoff.
Okay.
Krista
Vernoff, yeah. So, Krista, can people follow you on Twitter?
They can.
At their own risk.
They can follow me at their own risk. I swear a lot.
She be going in. So let's tell the kids what we were talking about before we went on. I know you got to run.
I am good.
So I was telling Krista that I had retweeted one of her tweets the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And you were going in about, you know, don't follow me if you're doing this. And boom, like, you just kind of made this.
What I said is.
Go ahead. Be specific.
I said something like, from here on out, you're an asshole to me, you will be blocked, because I am fucking done defending my very long career of advocacy and activism.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. That is what I said. Like,
yes.
I hit a wall with the baby. There's something that's happened with this generation that's coming up where they think there should be, like, trigger warnings on classic literature.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Where it's, and And where I think this is maybe – this is not fair. Like, I remember my mom said the same thing about my generation. Like, it's not fair. It's just that 18 and 19 and 20-year-olds and 25-year-olds think they know the way and it's the only way.
Yes.
And it's usually a very idealistic way. And they want you to do the thing the way that they want you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened for me on Twitter is that I was invited to sit on a panel that GLAAD through in at the ATX festival about the Lexa Pledge, which is in response to the barrier gays trope. There's a problem with the number of gays and lesbians who are killed on television shows as compared to representation. So basically, like, there's a statistic that is terrifying where it's like 2% of all representation is gay and bisexual women on TV, but 10% of deaths are gay and bisexual women.
Really?
And it's deeply concerning.
Right.
Orlando, you know what I mean? Like, it's deeply concerning, and television does have the ability to shape minds and thoughts and progress lack of progress. But for me, what I talked about on the panel was that I couldn't sign the Lexa Pledge, which you can go online and read, because it is limiting. I feel that this group of passionate young people who wrote it, and I think they also wrote it with TV writers and producers, so I don't know what age anybody is. They're passionate. God bless them.
Sure.
They wrote a pledge. It asks me to say that the first point. It says, any LGBT character that I create that has any meaning or significance to the show will have his or her own meaningful and significant arc. That's point one. Okay. And then it goes on from there to ask me to commit that I will never kill an LGBT character in service of a straight character's storyline. And that I will, there's a lot of things.
This is almost like the Bechdel test, but worse.
Yeah. it's asking me to pledge.
And I'm a gay man. So,
that I will always and never, in my storytelling and in my writing.
And
what I said is I can't even commit to point one, because what that point does for me, I talked about this on Twitter before I hit the wall. I tried to explain, like, if in the story of my life, in the movie of my life, which is where I always start, even on Shameless, I start from my truth, right? On Grey's Anatomy, I start from my truth and then I tell a story. But if I were writing the movie of my life, Peter Page would be a meaningful and significant character. He has been my best friend for more years than I'll admit, because it was.
And if you don't know him, Google him, bitch. Google him.
Google him. He created the Fosters, and he was in the cast of Queer as Folk. And I know that the gay best friend
and a brilliant actor.
A brilliant actor, brilliant director, brilliant screenwriter. The gay best friend is a trope.
Yes.
It's a trope.
Yes.
Okay, it's a trope. It's also
a real thing.
It's a real thing. thing. And in my life, if I were writing the story of my life, Peter would be in every scene. But he would not have a meaningful and significant arc of his own separate from me. If I sign this pledge, I can't write the gay best friend anymore.
It's censorship.
If I sign this pledge, I can't have, for example, one of the things I'll often do in a show that's maybe about straight people or in a story is I'll make the doctor that, you know, somebody's diagnosing somebody with breast cancer. Maybe she's gay. Maybe we see her leaving with her wife and kids. Maybe she's recurring and we let her be gay so that people in the middle of the country can go, you know, gay people are heroes among us. They are doctors who are helping to keep us alive.
That's right.
She does not have a meaningful and significant arc of her own. I can't sign the pledge. What I was saying is, yes, I will. Thank you for educating me about the trope.
Sure.
I will work even harder to not kill these characters and to really ask if we're considering letting someone catch a stray bullet, does it need to be that person?
Yeah.
But for my whole career, I've been the person from before I had any authority in television, I've been the writer sitting in the room going, can the gay man not be the pedophile? Can the gay man not be the murderer? He's the only one on the 20 episodes. Can he not? Like, activating. I have been an advocate for the LGBTQ community for my whole life. I come from the theater. And there were listeners in the audience, and there are these people on Twitter who were telling me, saying over and over, hammering me that I wasn't an advocate, that I'm not an activist if I won't sign this pledge.
Wow.
That if I am saying that this pledge limits my creativity, well, fuck you. Get some better creativity.
Wow.
Well, fuck you. You know, the fact that you're thinking about it, well, that's a start. I'm like, a start, bitch? You're 18. Let me talk to you about what I was doing. You're like, I'm like, out of my fucking mind. And And I felt a little bit like I follow Anne Lamott. I follow older women who were out of their minds when people were saying that Hillary Clinton isn't a feminist, like Bernie people saying Hillary Clinton isn't a feminist. And they were like, bitch, please. Yeah. Like, do you know what we did for your generation? Right. Do you know how hard we fought? Do you know what a fucking scandal it was when she came to the White House with Rodham in her middle name? And they're out of their minds and they're blocking. These very spiritual older women are blocking people. And that's how I felt. I felt like, oh, I understand.
Yeah.
Because when you've spent your life fighting for something and a younger generation wants to come up and tell you that you did it wrong, you're doing it wrong, or you're not doing enough, and really pigeonhole you without even looking at your work. It's infuriating.
And they have no idea your relationship with Peter and et cetera.
They don't know shit about me, and they're not looking at my work. And it made, and I tried so hard to be spiritual. I'm so spiritual, and I'm so loving, and I'm trying to be so gentle. And then I was like, bitch, please.
Yes.
I have had enough. More of my energy is going to this. I'm just going to keep being who I am. I'm an advocate. I'm an activist. I'm a human being. I'm a feminist. I put it all in my writing. And... what, and if you want to do it better than me, come to Hollywood. Come to Hollywood. And I don't mean that as a fuck you. I mean that as an invitation. Come. Tell your own story.
Bring it, bitch.
Do it your way. Bring it. I'll read your script. If it's good, I will stack you. Bring it.
Good shit.
I got to use that one. I got to high five you on that one, girl. That's
Thank
what's
you
up.
Very much.
High fives across the podcast.
Chris Tavernoff, y'all. That's very what's up. So, on that note, I go, can them bitches follow you on Twitter?
Those bitches can follow me on Twitter. I love the kids. I love everybody who's passionate and advocates. I just think we have to be gentler and carefuler about how we ask for help. You know what I mean? Like, like, I get it. I get when people are angry. I get it. I'm a woman. I would like to see women stop being, you know, just the dead corpse that the camera lingers on so we can tell a story about these men. You know what I mean? Like, there is more work to do. But I also really want to acknowledge how far we've come. And I wish that the same people who are organizing assault campaigns and letter writing campaigns asking for this trope that needs to change, that sometimes we would also organize. I write letters when women, when people write extraordinary women and start changing the tropes around women, I write a thank you letter. You know what I mean? Like, and when I get thank you letters, they mean so much more to me than attacks. And when people say, you know, I wrote a story, an episode of Grey's Anatomy about my father's death. I put it on George's character.
George's
father. Very autobiographical. And I got hundreds and hundreds of letters of people saying, thank you so much. I couldn't feel my feelings till I watched your story. Or thank you for telling this story. And that makes me realize how important my work is and how much voice I can give to people who are struggling to find their own. And so when I get letters from LGBT kids about, you know, Mickey and Ian that are like, let me tell you what this story means to me. Let me tell you what it meant to me and thank you for it. And can we not leave him in prison?
Yeah.
That means so much more to me.
I can't tell you how many times me and my husband watching went, no, do not put Ian with somebody else. He needs to be with Mickey. You know what I mean? It's like, no, don't
but
do it. You
over.
Want them to be together.
You want them to be together.
You
the
want them to
over,
be together.
Ask for it in a way that acknowledges the work we did to make you care that deeply. And it, so it's that's all. I just think we talk to people in a way, and that's why I was reluctant to send that tweet. That's why I tried to keep engaging gently and saying, wait a minute, let me explain, let me explain, let me explain. And then I was just like,
fuck it.
I broke my own rule. But actually, my rule is, if you wouldn't say it to a person sitting across the table, you shouldn't write it online.
True.
If you, but the truth is, you've heard my mouth now. I would say that to somebody
who's
attacking me across the table.
Real,
you know what I mean? So. So that's, you know, sometimes let's raise our voices. Let's be activists, but let's be kinder to each other. And we're all on the same side, you know, at least we in this conversation, we're on the same side.
Definitely.
We're debating about the means to the same end.
But like I said, I retweeted it because I was like, you better go, girl.
I love
you.
That
you better
just
tell your shit.
Retweeted my bitch.
I did. I was like, that shit right there tells me all about you. I was like, go, bitch.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So, thanks for inviting me to do this.
Thank you so much for coming.
You.
This was awesome. And tell Peter I don't want him on my damn show.
I'm gonna
make sure he's in the mix of the tweet.
I'm gonna do it. It's
damn
done.
It. He know who I am.
For sure.
So are you just Chris Tavernoff? on Twitter.
Hey, you know what? This podcast comes out tomorrow on Peter's birthday.
Oh, is it birthday tomorrow? Oh, I did see that on Facebook.
Happy birthday, Peter.
Happy birthday, Peter.
Thank you for all that you do in all of our lives, and especially mine.
And come on my show. Where are you at, Tracy Grant?
On Twitter, at The Real Trey, R-E-E-L-T-R-A-Y. Get at me. I will help you get your life right.
That's what's up. And I'm your host, Hilliard Guest. I can't even speak right now. Hilliard Guest, you guys can follow me on Twitter at Hilliard Guest. You guys can follow the show, Screenwriters RR, on Twitter. I say Twitter like I'm cool.
Twitter.
You guys can please go on screenwritersrantroom at gmail.com if you have any questions for us. And also go on iTunes. Give us a 5-star review. We really need that for The Matrix. I got a feeling it's going to be a big episode. Everybody's going to be talking about it.
It's a jewel.
It's going to be crazy.
No question.
It's gonna
so
be
nice.
Nothing but game, girl.
Thanks,
that's what I love.
Guys.
Nothing but game. Yes. So I want you to join in with us when we say 2016 instead of keeping it 100.
All right.
So y'all know how we're doing on Rant Room. On this show, we keep it real. We keep it opinionated. And we keep it what, everybody?
2016.
Peace, y'all. Yeah.
In the Rant Room, we say stars can be paid. There gotta be a dope ass story on the page. Let the beast about the cage, that light about the dark. Can you build the inferno from an itty bitty spark? Coffee shop hustlers rise with the cream. A million other writers, same Hollywood dream. Your pen and paper all like bullets in the gun. Write what you feel, say what you want. In the red room, we say what we say, we do. We gotta keep it real
in the Rant Room.
All about the crap of screenwriting. Fill my bottle up with lightning. Up in the Rant Room.
So look, if you guys are grown, let's go ahead and get in. Mm-hmm.